Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's episode is something we haven't done before. We've got a two-for-one, two exclusive interviews about Europe's new unified patent court. The first part of the show features a conversation with Judge Michael Floyhis of the Unified Patent Court. Eli was able to sit down with Judge Floyhis during his recent visit to the United States. Later in the episode, Eli sits down for a fun conversation with European patent attorney Dr. Benjamin Grau, a close observer of the UPC. Dr. Grau shares unique insights and creative strategies for obtaining the best possible patent protection in post-UPC Europe. If you want to learn more about what to expect from the UPC, or the keys to success in post-UPC Europe, you don't want to miss this episode. And now on to part one with Judge Michael Floyhis.
You've been in this role for about 6 months, 7 months now. From your viewpoint, why was the UPC created in the first place?
Oh, I think the idea of having a common court to the European Union, or as much as possible, that's a very old idea. The discussion started in the late 70s, I think. And it was always a long discussion going on and off, and it never really came into place. And then I think at around 2009, there was another attempt to start the Unified Patent Court, and that attempt appeared to have made it through to the final ratification of the agreement, and here we are with a unified patent court for the European Union. Currently, it's only a subsection of the European Union for the countries that have started this enhanced collaboration, which is an instrument under the European Union contracts, rarely used. But in this case, it was the solution to the everlasting problem.
Do you think there's anything special about this point in time? Why finally they were discussing it for a long time and they finally were able to come to an agreement and make it work?
I can really not tell you because it's a very, very political thing. Of course, the European Union politics is super complex. And I'm not entirely sure why at this particular point in time it suddenly started working. There was definitely the idea to make use of this instrument of the enhanced cooperation. That was the changing point. Like that allowed them to actually progress the whole establishment of the court. Whereas before, when there was the attempt to really get everybody on board, it just didn't work out.
And I'm sure a lot of the people who came to that agreement had a lot of different goals in mind. But do you think there's one overarching goal for the existence of the UPC?
Oh, of course, the situation as it used to be before the UPC, or still is in terms of under certain circumstances, that you litigate patents in multiple countries, in multiple courts or different courts, very many procedures at the same time. All of this adds to the cost, and one major idea or one major requirement was to bring the costs of patent litigation down, to streamline the procedure, to simply make it worthwhile enforcing your patents.
You're a UPC technical judge, I think that's the correct terminology, but can you give us a little sense of what is the typical proceeding that you handle at a local division?
So technical judges are added to the procedure either based on request by the parties, for example, in infringement procedures or preliminary injunction procedures. The party can request a technical judge to be part of a panel. That's one side of the game. The other side of the game is during procedures.
Just to simplify for some people who might not be familiar at all, so let's say somebody files, patent infringement lawsuit at the UPC. Do they randomly get assigned one judge? Is that when they request it? How does that kind of work?
No, they get assigned. Obviously, the distribution of the judges is set, of the legal judges. Yeah. And then the person or the party filing the complaint, they could simply request that a technical judge be added to the panel. And then based on that, based on the technology, there is a select number of judges that would be selected for this case, or that could be selected for this case. And all this is done after a very thorough conflict check by the technical judges, because the technical judges are no full-time judges. There are part-time judges and being added to the cases. And all of them at the moment still have other assignments too.
We were talking earlier today, and I found out that you're a second-generation patent attorney. Your father was a patent attorney. You had experience both on the litigation and prosecution side. You have your own firm. Why did you decide to become a UPC judge, and what was the process like?
The main decision to at least apply for the position as a judge is based on a purely emotional thing, really. I am a very pro-European person, so I think the European Union is a phenomenal institution. And I just thought that if I can help shape the system or help the system to evolve, to strengthen the community, the European Union community, I should do the best I can and help. So this was the main reason for me, the main motivation for me to apply for the position. The process was, I think, a standard process. We sent in applications. We received invites for interviews, and then after the interviews, and I think the presidium had a lot of interviews to do. After these interviews, we just got our letters of appointment, or not appointment at that point in time, but we got informed that we would be having a position if we agreed, and then we agreed. And
did you get a mail, like a letter through a mail or an email? How's that?
No, it was a proper letter. It was sent by email, but it was a proper letter.
Do you remember where were you when you found out? Or
it was right in the middle of August, and I was actually in my summer vacation when I received this letter, and it took me quite a while until I finally processed what I read there. In the end, it's fine, but it's still strange when you come from a different world and then suddenly get accepted to this type of very interesting position.
One relatively unique aspect of being a UPC judge is that it's your part-time position. I mean, how do you juggle that with also being up in private practice, like on a practical level?
On a practical level, it means that I had to discuss with my partners, and I got approval from my partners to basically make the time whenever the time is needed. That's the status quo. And I don't think this is a big problem, or it won't be a problem, simply because, let's face it, your partners wouldn't really want to keep you away from helping to evolve the law or helping to evolve the system in which they're a part of themselves.
And the legally qualified judges, they're also part-time?
Some of the legally qualified judges are full-time.
Okay.
A select number, in particular the position of the presidents and so on. The other legally qualified judges, as far as I understand, are some of them are part-time and also have the assignments in the respective national courts that they had before the assignment to the Unified Patent Court.
When somebody files a case at the UPC, they are going to have a legally qualified judge. You can't avoid that, and then they might request a technical judge. Once you're both on a case, are your roles any different? Are you doing everything together? How does that work on a practical level?
I think that needs to show. Nobody really knows yet exactly how this is going to work in practice across the board. These cases where technically qualified judges have been assigned so far, I wasn't part of these boards, so I can't really tell you from any particular knowledge. I think that the technically qualified judges are involved in the handling of the procedure. The agreement doesn't really make a difference between the judge positions there. But of course, it's only natural that the technically qualified judges will look at the whole thing with more technical eyes and the legally qualified judges will look at it with the legal qualified eye. The interaction seems to be very collegial and professional, as far as I hear, and I think that is all we would like to see.
You mentioned that some of the legally qualified judges, they worked on the German Federal Patent Court and other courts, so they've been trying cases for a long time. What is that dynamic like, right? Somebody has done this, I don't know, 100 or 1,000 times, and here you are a technically qualified judge, and you have a similar role, but you're kind of working with somebody with that kind of level expertise.
I would say, at least for myself, there is definitely going to be a learning curve. Yeah. I mean, there is just less experience on this side of the game. Sitting as a judge is a different thing than being in front of a judge or in front of a court, and that will be experience gained, I'm sure.
The reason I'm kind of thinking about it is that in the U.S., if somebody becomes a district court judge, he's the judge, right? Until he gets appealed, he'll be making the decisions. Nobody's going to be saying, well, you haven't done it quite as long as I have. Do you think that's any kind of issue navigating that? Or is that, like you said, because it's so collegial, it's kind of a natural for the experienced legally qualified judges and the UPC technical judges to work together? Kind of.
I can hardly answer that. I think the main thing is none of the judges, be it legally qualified judges, of course, yeah, but also the technically qualified judges, is an inexperienced person in that field. We all have a very decent amount of experience in patent litigation cases. So we have at least seen a lot of this. We may not have been in the same position, of course,
yeah,
but we've experienced a fair bit of how these procedures work, what you do, what the judges seem to be doing when you look at it from the other side. I think it will be probably not too hard to convey this or transfer this into how to work with on a bank.
You've been thinking about these issues for a while, even though you haven't been making the rulings. You've been doing it a while from representing clients in a litigation perspective. How's that informing your role as a UPC judge in this new court that, I guess, based on your experience in other courts before this?
I believe it's a very valuable thing to actually having seen the whole procedure from the side of the representatives. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very valuable thing always, in any case, to see or to look at these things from multiple sides. It will only add to the experience. It will probably help understand parties better, or understanding the procedures or reasons for this or that, what a party can do a little better. I'm certain that this experience is extremely helpful.
Is there anything, I guess, through your career that when you were representing clients in a litigation setting, you were kind of thinking, well, I wish courts did something differently, or if there was a new court one day, I wish it did A, B, and C. Have you?
I mean, naturally, if you're in a court case, depending on whether you lose or win the case, you will probably have your opinion about the court, whether it was correct or incorrect, from your probably very limited view in at that time, and also because you were representing your client. But I'm also aware of the fact that there will always have to be one side that is likely not happy with a decision and the other side that may be happy with a decision. This is one of the things of being a judge is, you know, you have to make a decision. You can't get around the decision. And maybe that's also one of the qualifications that I think make up a good judge, is simply being able to make a decision and not trying to avoid a decision, depending on the facts that are being presented to you. Yeah. Full stop. That's the job, is making a decision.
Yeah. You know, in the US, what I'm more familiar with, district court judges rightly see that a big part of the role is helping litigants come to an agreement, a settlement, outside of a full-blown trial? Because on a practical level, there's no way every lawsuit that gets filed in the U.S., you know, could have its own trial. In Europe, at the UPC, is there any kind of thinking about the role of settlements, the role of alternative dispute resolutions? How does that come into your role as a UPC judge?
Part of the unitary patent court agreement, or part of the unitary patent court, is indeed a mediation and arbitration center. So it is already ingrained in the system. It's not just that the judges have to work and try to get the parties maybe to settle their case, but this might be the task, or this might be the role of the, or it is likely the role of the mediation and arbitration center. There is definitely alternative dispute resolution is part of the system.
And do you think it's like a parallel track to the UPC judges are doing, or is that kind of in different steps throughout the proceeding?
That I can tell you, because it's largely going to be the parties that are going to take or make use of these procedures. And I don't know whether the parties will always go through the mediation arbitration center or will tend to go more straight in front of the court.
It's not mandatory, I guess.
It's not mandatory, no.
So you've been in this role, I think I mentioned that. Is it 7 months now? Or what has it been like for you from the moment you got the letter to now? Anything you learned during this time?
Oh, I certainly learned a great deal already. And I one of the important bits is that I got to know the judges, or the fellow judges that are also technical judges and legal judges in the court. And I understood that this is a phenomenal team of judges that have come together in this new project. The allocation of technical judges has happened already. There have been cases where technical judges have been allocated, but it's not that for every procedure that has so far been decided, or where there has been an order, a technical judge was part of the procedure. And this will probably never be the case, because some of these orders and decisions can be without technical judges, and I would assume that some of them will be without technical judges.
You know, the realities of global patent litigation is, if a patent owner has patents in various jurisdictions, they have to make a decision, right? Where am I going to try to enforce first, second, and so forth, in hopes of maybe eventually reaching some kind of global settlement? And that's how these things kind of play out these days. If somebody's taking a look now at all the different options available, how should they think about the UPC as an option?
I think this is, I mean, it has been the same thing in Europe, that you had certain national litigation procedures, and once they were decided, then very often the parties settled the remaining case, or the case in the remaining countries. Yeah. That was standard procedure. Whether or not parties are now going to bring their case in front of the UPC rather than a national court remains to be seen. I cannot foresee this. I think that the UPC is definitely in a very good position to become the go-to court, mainly because of its very capable judge body, and also because the entire UPC was created, and the rules in particular, to be very efficient. The UPC procedures are going to be very efficient, very fast. And so maybe that's a reason why parties would in future go and bring their case in front of UPC, simply because they get a very timely decision then.
Is there a rule, I guess, how quickly a proceeding needs to wrap up, anything like that?
Well, yes, there is timings that are defined in the rules. Obviously, the procedures in the specific case can deviate from these timings, but the rules are such that they would like, and probably in very many cases do, foresee a oral proceedings and a decision within about 12 months of bringing action.
One thing that I guess I've been hearing a lot about the UPC is that there's a fear by litigants of the unknown, right? This is something new. They know the judges are great. They know it's been formed with the best intentions, but they just don't quite know what happens after we file, what will happen after we file suit. I mean, any thoughts about that kind of, if somebody has that kind of fear about filing suit?
Well, my response to this would be that it is actually not as unknown as people would think it is, because the judges that are now sitting at the UPC, at least the legal judges in the local chambers most of the time, they used to be the most experienced litigation judges, patent litigation judges in the respective countries around Europe. So if you look at what they did before and how they worked before, and you were happy, say, going in front of a German chamber or Italian chamber, then you should likewise be happy to bring your case in front of these same chambers in the respective countries. Yes, there will be an additional judge from a different country on the panel, but I doubt strongly that the decision will be less sound than it would have been before in the respective division. Quite the opposite.
Obviously, a victory at the UPC more valuable than a victory within one of those national courts, right? In terms of
the litigation values are higher, are likely to be higher. Yeah. That depends on the plaintiffs most of the time. We are going to see whether the victory in itself will be more valuable. Certainly, the geographical region that a victory would apply to is larger.
Yeah. You know, let's say somebody finally decides to file a suit at the UPC. Any advice about how to be effective at the UPC, similar to being effective European National Court, or maybe different? You mentioned the timeline being a quick timeline being an aspect, but any other advice about being an effective litigant?
Yeah, my greatest piece of advice would be don't slack. The deadlines or the timelines are very strict and very short. Sorry, the timelines are very short. And there is no time for a long wait or a long decision period. I think if the parties will just sit there and wait and hope and maybe try and strategize when they should bring what argument, that may actually backfire at some point. I truly believe that it is a virtue to, in general, that's a personal opinion. I think in general, it's a virtue to present the case and don't try and strategize too much. Maybe that is also a national thing, because the procedures used to be very efficient already in Germany. Yeah. And the rule was you don't try and play games and wait to bring arguments at a later point, even if you had them before, because it may backfire. And at the Unitary Patent Court, I think being careful to present your case straight away, straightforward, at the beginning of the procedure or as early as you're supposed to present your case, not wait, not try and delay, that is what will help you in these procedures.
Just so I understand that better, I guess, in terms of over-strategizing, like you might decide, well, I'm only going to bring this up argument when they do, the other side does X, Y, or Z. But you're saying just litigants should just put their best arguments forward about why they should win on the merits.
I think, as you say, bringing the best argument, or maybe also the second best, and not waiting until the last moment when you might be in a position to bring it, is a good idea. Bring an argument, or trying to bring an argument only at oral proceedings will, at the very least, cause some eyebrows being raised. Sometimes it is necessary or not impossible to prevent, but it is a procedure that will definitely want you to bring your arguments as early as possible.
You mentioned how similar the UPC will be to, you know, the sort of national patent courts, just because of the judges that come from there and the pedigree of this. Anything that's different that kind of sticks out to you between litigating at the UPC and, let's say, litigating at the German Federal Patent Court?
Oh yeah, the entire rules of procedure, completely different. It's a entirely new court with a new rule set, with new substantive laws included in that. So I'd say everything is different. Probably everything is different because it's based on new rules. It may work the same way, but it's a different basis.
Anything that sticks out to you, I guess, significant difference or besides everything?
I think I'm probably not at liberty to say anything like that, yeah. But I would guess it will show over time.
Another, I guess, interesting, when I think when American attorneys hear about the UPC, you know, there's a lot of interesting aspects about it, especially having a court where judges speak different languages and you get a choice of language and so forth. I mean, what is your thought about that? What role does the language play at making arguments in English versus German versus Italian? You know?
Well, the first thing that struck me when I got to know many of the judges was that they all had very good command of English, first of all. And then secondly, I did not meet a judge so far that was only proficient in at least two languages, but some of them are proficient in many more languages. I think the languages are probably not going to be as much of an issue as people thought they might. There have been cases where languages were switched, or where the language of the procedure was switched. So this is possible, for example, if the parties agree and the court agrees, then you could switch the language of the procedure. A larger number of cases were filed in Germany before the Munich Local Chamber in German language. And my suspicion would be that given almost all chambers or divisions allow English as a language of the procedure, I would personally guess that English is going to be the most popular language, also because most European patents are granted in English. But I can't foresee this. It may be different, but I don't see languages to pose a big issue there, because the judges are really very proficient in different languages.
As you look ahead, I think we've mentioned a few times, it's still early in the game, I guess. What do you see happening with UPC, I guess, in the short term and the longer term? I guess, how do you see its development? Anything that kind of sticks out to you?
Well, it's kind of foreseen that the UPC is going to be the European Patent Litigation Court. And I believe that this is going to be its position. It's going to be, I believe, I hope, it's going to become a go-to court for patent litigation, because it's very efficient and will produce high-quality decisions. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting no less than that.
The go-to court globally, not just...
Maybe even a go-to court globally, yes. Yeah. Because of both economic and time-based efficiency.
It's new for the judges themselves, being a judge and so forth, and they're hearing about things that other divisions are doing or other panels are doing and so forth. You know, how will that have an impact, or like, how are you... maybe it's a European thing, right? I don't know, are judges looking at other judges' decisions? Are they looking at how other cases are handled? What is the impact?
I think judges do have to look at other decisions and make up their minds about it. And that hasn't been different in the European Union before the UPC. The European Union, you always, or in many cases, you had decisions issue which had looked at and discussed decisions from other countries in relation to the same parties or the same patent litigation. That is a relatively normal thing, and I think it's important to do this and to evaluate the decisions carefully and see whether you agree or do not agree. And both ways, you have to give your reasons, and you have to make up your mind about it, and you have to give your reasons. That's a standard thing. And I think it will only improve the entire system if you take other decisions into consideration and try and make sure that the decision or the case you're dealing with, which is in most cases slightly different than any other case, whether this is a similar situation or not.
And what is the role of the UPC Court of Appeal?
Oh, of course. The Court of Appeal is always the appeal instance. It'll have to verify whether a decision was made correctly or not. And it will obviously also be an instance that takes care that there is harmony between the decisions and in the Unified Patent Court.
Any final thoughts about any of the topics we discussed or anything else that you want the listeners of Clause 8 to know about being a UPC judge and the UPC court?
I think from my personal perspective, as I said, I am a European throughout, and I think it's a fantastic thing that I can be not only part of, but I also witness the birth of a new court system. That in itself is something that excites me a lot. I think this is a tremendously interesting thing, seeing a court and a jurisdiction come into place. And I'm obviously super happy having the chance to become part of this, even actively.
Well, thank you so much for coming on Clause 8.
Thank you, Eli.
And now on to part two of today's episode. A conversation with Dr. Benjamin Grau.
What is it like working with somebody who's whenever they put on their cape, they become a judge, you know, but when you work with them, they're a patent attorney?
It has some impact on the business, obviously. The conflict checks might get a bit more complicated because we are not allowed to handle any clients who Michael is responsible for in his position as a judge.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is something to handle, to work out, no problem. Apart from that, Michael keeps it perfectly separated as he has to do, so we don't have any insights.
What has it been like to see his success, I guess, on a personal level? And you actually started as a trainee at the firm, right?
Yeah, well, I know Michael for a very long time, 30 years now, something from our, no, 25 from our time doing PhD. For both of us, it was life prior to being patent attorneys. And I have to admit, I'm really proud of Michael. I mean, he's an excellent attorney, and I think it's more than justified that he was selected to be one of the judges. I think it's great. It's fantastic.
I'm sure everybody in the patent field has been watching the UPC, the formation and the creation and the selection of the judges and all that. But you've been closer to the action, I guess, there in Munich. I mean, what has, from your perspective, what have been the first 6 months like of the UPC?
Well, you might know that before the start of the UPC, there was a so-called sunrise period where certain actions were able to be taken at the UPC, the famous opt-out, so the removal of existing European patents from the jurisdiction of the new court system.
Yeah.
And I think during that period, the start was a bit difficult, which was mainly to IT reasons. The UPC has developed a completely new content management system and required high level of authentication. And for us as the representatives, the start was difficult because the software wasn't working well. We as the representatives weren't able to record ourselves as representatives because we simply didn't have the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And also for the opt-out, it was difficult in the beginning to get the request through due to IT issues.
I guess for listeners who are not as familiar as you with the UPC, I guess if you had a European patent that you got from a European patent office, you had the option of opting out of the UPC's. And then what were the benefits of it? I guess maybe you could...
Well, it was a funny situation because normally if there's introduced something new, in this case, a new court system, you would it would require active decision to use the new court.
Yeah.
In this case, it was different. It required an active decision, an action to remain in within the old system.
Yeah, but you still have an option then later on to move to opt-in, right? Re-opt-in, I guess.
you can do this once, and it was during that sunrise period where before the onset of the court, you had the possibility to remove existing patents from the jurisdiction of the court. It was more than 500,000 patents opted out, which shows that actually people were really more than skeptical whether they want to be within the new system. If you do, it's very difficult to do statistics on the number of existing European patents, but I would expect it's almost half of the European patents or the patents granted by the European Patent Office, which have been removed from the jurisdictions of the new court. So I think the entire beginning of the new structure was a bit less enthusiastic as someone might have expected.
What were you advising clients? Were you advising clients to opt out case by case basis? Kind of, what was your perspective?
I'll have to provide the typical answer of a lawyer. It depends.
Yeah.
No, but it really should be on the case by case basis. I mean, the problem is if you, for example, only acting in one or two countries of the European Union and you don't care about all the rest because it's simply not in your market. I would opt out because you're on the safe side because you're only attackable within these two jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And
in terms of having your patent canceled or...
Exactly. And if the patent is, if it's the most important patent for your business, it might be a good idea to have them a bit on the safe side also if you have established litigation strategies.
On the safe side by opting out?
Yes.
Okay.
If you have established litigation strategies, which are based on, for example, doing infringement proceedings in Germany and then settle in all the other countries, it might still be a good option to keep it that way because in total, litigation might stay a bit cheaper in the end. The problem with the new court, the court fees are pretty much the same as, for example, court fees in Germany.
Yeah.
But the amount of recoverable costs is significantly higher. For that reason, it really has to be the decision of remaining within the new system or going to the new court or remaining in the old system should be taken on a case-by-case basis.
So it was a surprise to the UPC about all this opt-outs, it seems. But was it were you surprised by that?
Yes and no. I've been giving a couple of talks in preparation of the UPC, and actually I gave a talk 2016, which was just prior to the Brexit, and everybody was already... had the idea that the new court would start, then came Brexit, so the UK leaving the European Union, everything was delayed quite a lot. Giving these talks, I noticed that many, many patent proprietors were rather reluctant and skeptical. So I'm not really astonished about the numbers.
Now that the court has been in existence for 6 months, anything else that has surprised you about its operations, about any of the news that you hear about the various decisions and so forth? Has anything surprised?
What we see from the decisions, it's extremely effective. So what has been promised regarding the timeline of getting decisions and the effectiveness of the new court system actually came through. So this is really, it is really the case.
You're seeing suits resolved within a year, I guess, or from filing, or even quicker?
Yeah. So this is really good. What astonished me now is that we have some experience, and you already mentioned that after opting out a patent, you still have the possibility to get in the court again. From these 500,000 to 600,000 opt-outs, we only have 1,000 patents opted in again.
Okay.
I thought that actually after having a bit experience and see how the court works, that more people would go within the system again. but it might still take some time.
You know, there's a lot of takes, right, about the UPC, about it's transparent, not transparent. Any of those takes that has surprised you that, you know, the way people are kind of evaluating the way the UPC is working or not working?
As I said, there were some IT issues and there was a bit of IT bashing in the beginning. These issues now have been solved out. And I think it's really seems to be a proper and very good court system.
Yeah,
I will be excited to how it develops in the end.
When I talked to Judge Michael Flores, you know, he says a goal for the UPC is to be the destination court for patent litigation. I mean, from your perspective, what do you think will success for the UPC look like?
I mean, the regulations or the legislation behind the UPC is quite clear that also this option of opting out European patents only will exist for a maximum of 14 years. So the legislator already gave the direction that it will be the court. And unless people move to national patents, like national German filings or national French patents, it will automatically become the court for European litigation. And this is something which one has to acknowledge. It is all around Europe, the really experienced litigation judges, which are within the system. And if the quality of the decisions, together with the speed of decisions, I mean, you're a patent attorney as well, it's nothing worse than waiting 3, 5, 4 years for a decision if it's a complicated case.
Yeah.
This is disappointing. And this really will make it a success overall. I'm pretty convinced on that.
So it seems, at least based on the rules, initial proceeding has to take, a decision has to be rendered within about a year. What about the appeals process? Is there any time limit set on that?
It will be pretty much in the same framework,
okay.
I assume. It'll depend, like usual, how busy the courts of appeal will be.
Yeah.
There's always a theoretic approach. It should be like this. In the end, they are too busy and it takes longer. But the entire proceedings, it is also, if you have oral proceedings, at the end of any case, they are supposed to last one day only, which is rather short. But the idea is the parties are not intended to present the entire story again, just providing additional arguments, and the court will decide. So again, it's all streamlined for efficiency, and I think it will work out.
You know, one of the theories you heard when the UPC was being created was, all these local divisions in these different countries are going to be competing with each other to be the friendlier destination. Do you think there's any validity to that concern? How do you imagine that to play out?
I don't think so. Because you always have the kind of mixture of national judges from this country and foreign judges, which are on the same panel. I don't think there will be a competition about friendliness or patentee friendly or infringer friendly. What I might think of someone would select a certain division, a certain chamber for due to the language.
Yeah.
And obviously the judges should handle the languages, but if you file a lawsuit in a rather exotic language, which is not English, and the parties have to translate everything for their clients, this translation requirement within the tight framework will be extremely challenging. And therefore, even though the language shouldn't matter, for us as the representatives, it will be extremely busy. You know, if you have to translate a complaint of 40 pages.
Right.
It's challenging. And therefore...
And both ways. Translate what you're getting and what you'll be able to...
Exactly. And they are also, under the current German system, sometimes you might file an opposition at the EPO in German just to annoy the other party.
U.S. litigation attorneys might have a different perspective sometimes you write a brief and might start with like a reference in a language, even though you might be fluent in that language, it might not it might not ring the same to you if you know it's your if you have the same reference points culturally or if it was your if you grew up speaking that language, for example. Is there anything, I guess, about the briefs or anything like that in the UPC that's different that you don't think it will or won't make a difference in terms of the language? Like if an Italian attorney refers to something that only likely only a Italian judge would know or something like that? Or...
To be honest, we already have this situation at the European Patent Office where we have examiners from different languages, and you notice if you have a... For example, a case which is a patent application in German, and and the entire examination division doesn't speak German. It's as mother language, as first language. It is sometimes really difficult, and I had cases where I've been discussing about grammar, German grammar, with a patent examiner from the Netherlands. And obviously you will have this, might have these problems at the UPC as well. And this is always, if you speak to someone in his first language, it's easier for him. If you have to speak a different language, there are always these hurdles. This is something you, I guess, you don't have as much in the US.
No, it's interesting because, you know, you get into these discussions sometimes about English words with US examiners, and it seems to you, you know, we're speaking different languages. So I imagine that's
well, so
doubly complicated.
I think it's double or three times the problems, but it will obviously exist the problems. But it's something. We in Europe we are kind of used to it.
Yeah, and I guess you know if you're the if you're an attorney representing somebody before the UPC, I imagine you have to be conscious of the panel as a whole, right? There's going to be judges from different jurisdictions. Like they have to be, at least two have to be from different countries, right?
Obviously, you might consider using a bit easier language. You know, in Germany, we have the, sometimes the Germans make very, 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 very long sentences. And this is very difficult to understand if you're not a native speaker. Yeah. So you might think of, if even if you write in German, you might make a bit easier grammar, use easier grammar and make easier sentences. You should consider this.
Well, in the US, they always say, like, if you have a case in Texas, you know, some attorney from New York is going to wear cowboy boots or something like that. I don't know how effective that is, but, you know. But I guess maybe If the jury was from all over, you'd have to be different. It seems like you're pretty optimistic about the direction of the UPC, and you gave some examples of where some litigants might still want to consider using just their national courts. If, for example, if their product is only sold in these particular countries or whatever. Anything else, I guess, that sticks out to you? Why you might advise a German company to use a German federal patent court versus the UPC at this point in time?
It really depends on the patent. It's very difficult to give a general rule on this.
But what kind of, I guess, factors about the patent that kind of?
Well, you mean for litigation or
litigation, yeah.
For litigation? Yeah. For example, it's another issue for the UPC that the prior art slightly differs. You have these elder national rights, which are only relevant, which only works for Germany, but you might have elder national rights for, of other countries, which would be considered prior art then. So this might occasion...
And so what are... Can you... What?
These are patents or patent applications which are pre-filed but post-published.
Okay.
And this is different level of prior art. This is, doesn't happen very often, but it might happen. And these are occasions where you should really think about where to go. For if you litigate a patent, normally the response to litigation is a nullity action.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a typical behavior, and you should be aware of prior art.
So different prior art rules. You should think about all these issues, I guess, before.
And if you really only need a title in litigation for Germany, just from a cost perspective, I would remain with the German court system because it's in the end. For the same result, to get the right to prohibit something within Germany, you'll get the same product for a cheaper price.
You know, you've talked a lot about, you know, the advice that you're giving to clients. It's a case-by-case basis. That's why we're in the business we're in. But what will you be watching at the UPC now to figure out how to get the best patents at the UPC or not enforced at the UPC, I guess? What will you be watching for?
Well, we'll definitely watching the decisions which are already coming out of the UPC to see whether it's in line with what we expected from our experience, for example, in Germany. By now, it seems to be all the decisions seem to be well-founded and reasonable. I haven't read anything so far which really surprised me that I said, oops, this goes in the wrong direction. So it really, we have to see how the court behaves, to be honest. But at the moment, it looks good, so I'm not really nervous.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, you know, the opting out is going to, that decision is going to come to an end where that's not going to be a choice anymore, I guess, once you get a...
We have now some decisions from the court about the opting out, whether it has been valid or invalid. And there's this scenario where you opt out a patent, then the national proceedings are started, so you aren't allowed to opt in again and things. And there has been this discussion in advance whether preliminary injunctions would be considered as a pending proceeding, which then would stop the possibility to opt in again. And I think this is more procedural stuff, which is now decided by the court, but it goes, I think, in a good direction.
You know, right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, you have the option of obtaining patent protection at the European Patent Office, and then you can get patent protection at the German Patent Office. Does the creation of the UPC and the opting out coming to an end, does that impact the strategy about that, about whether you should seek separate protection in these?
I think there's also one significant change we had prior to the UPC. They had this concept of prohibition of double protection. So it wasn't possible to get European patent and the German one at the same time. Funny enough, for the UPC, it has been changed. So you can have a unified patent or European patent with unitary effect and a German patent at the same time. So this gives you far more possibilities in building up your portfolio, simply making use of two separate patents directed to the same subject matter, having the choice to end up at different courts. And I think this will become more significant after these 7 to 14 years grace period where you have the possibility to opt out. So I think later on, I would recommend for very, very important inventions just to make use of both at the same time.
Yeah, that's definitely a strategy. I guess you can even, you could get different types of examination at the offices, different scope, maybe different infringement.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it opens a really completely new playing field for litigation if you have various IP rights at the same time.
Are you finding that's kind of a decision that is being made as a matter of course, or is it kind of the kind of thing that if you hear it's a very important patent, then patent attorneys are advising it? What is your sense?
Well, I would consider that it should be part of proper counseling for the clients that if a patent attorney has a feeling that this would be the best option, what should recommend it? I don't think it will be a generous strategy. I mean, it's a bit like a bit like with PCT applications. I mean, you don't need a PCT for every invention. If you already know where to go, why spend money for a PCT? But I know there are many colleagues who always file PCT applications and then go to the same countries afterwards. Yeah. Always, I think this is a bit difficult from counseling perspective for the clients.
No, that's interesting. Anything else, I guess, that sticks out to you about UPC, but also on the you know, the impact that it might have on patent prosecution?
I think it is the funding of the UPC is an extremely important step for Europe, for the European Union, as it brings things together. I mean, Europe is, if you compare size US and Europe, it's somehow ridiculous that you have to litigate that you had to litigate in all the different countries, and now you get a title for the entire Europe. And I think for the political evolution of Europe, it's extremely important to have this possibility of Europe-wide litigation. And I really do hope that other countries, most important. Maybe Spain will join the system, even though they declined in the beginning, just to support the idea of a common Europe.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the Clause 8 podcast and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me, Eloy.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.